From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Euro wobbles, J.P. Morgan losses, attack ad times, and tough political talk this week. In Des Moines, Iowa, Mitt Romney cranked up the debt clamor.
A prairie fire of debt is sweeping across Iowa and across the nation. And every day that we fail to act, that fire gets closer to the homes and the children we love.
In Youngstown, Ohio, Joe Biden said Romney's camp just doesn't get the importance of job and paycheck.
It's about your dignity. It's about your self-respect. It's about your place in your community. It's about who you are. These guys don't get that.
And all eyes on Europe as Greece stumbles.
A lot of pressure on the Europeans to really get a grip on the situation. Europe is risking pushing the entire globe back into a second recession in 4 years.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Chrystia Freeland of Thomson Reuters, John Healy of the Los Angeles Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Euro crisis, California crisis, Trayvon Martin evidence, Facebook. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Chrystia Freeland joins us this week from New York City. She's editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, right in the middle of global business and economics. Chrystia, welcome back. Great to have you.
Great to be with you.
John Healy joins us from Los Angeles. He's on the editorial board at the Los Angeles Times. California's been making a lot of noise this week. John Healy, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and John.
Chrystia, take us straight to this Greek situation and Europe and the G8 meeting coming up this week and the wobbling this week. Markets all over the world in trouble. Everybody looking at Greece and what's going to happen there. Where are we? Where's the cliff's edge? Where's Greece? Where's Europe, Chrystia?
Well, I think we're pretty close to the cliff's edge. I do think that, you know, markets have gotten really scared this week, and they're right to be scared, because if there is an uncontrolled, a disorganized Greek exit from the euro, the repercussions could really be, you know, they could make Lehman look like a walk in the park. So the potential disaster scenario would be Greece drops out of the euro. You have a run on the banks of the other weak European countries, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, even Italy. And Italy is a huge, huge bond. There are a lot of Italian bonds out there. Mm-hmm. And then you could really have, you know, if you had euro panic, if you had Germany in particular say, look, we're just not able to underwrite this, the euro fall apart, you know, you could really have chaos in Europe. And the eurozone is a huge part of the world economy. You know, you could really have the world economy plunged into a payments crisis, into a real recession. So that is the nightmare scenario. We're not there yet. Even if Greece does exit the euro, you know, this is not a surprise to people. Europeans have been thinking about this for a while. And the Europeans believe that they do have a firewall, that they have the European Central Bank has the ability to defend and support Spain in particular. That's the next country that's in the sights of the markets. But it is a very, very scary situation. And what makes it, you know, so difficult is Europe does not yet have a politically and economically credible medium-term solution to the fault lines that have been revealed by the crisis of the past few years.
And so here a lot of them come to the G8 at Camp David. They'll be gathering there tonight before the NATO summit in Chicago. I want to think about the trajectory of thinking about how to address this that we've seen this week. And here's a little sound from Tuesday in Berlin. The new French Socialist President François Hollande and German Prime Minister Angela Merkel held a joint press conference to discuss how the two nations would work together to find solutions to Europe's financial crisis.
Through the introduction of the euro and through the crisis we've experienced, we now have more sincere discussions. We have to find harder solutions. Just because we belong to different parties doesn't mean we cannot work together.
As the President of the Republic, I would like to negotiate what has been agreed. I would like to add some dimension of growth.
A dimension of growth, says the new French leader there. And they're talking harder solutions. Chrystia, John and Jack, I'll come to you. But Chrystia, first on G8, here they are. They're going to be sitting down at Camp David in the United States. Is this a setting where something meaningful could happen, or is this just a, you know, fretting session?
I think it could be an important setting, partly because of the timing, and also because, interestingly, you know, we think of the Europeans as being this cozy club, but Hollande and Merkel don't really have a strong relationship. So I think it could be important. I mean, I think what's really key right now, it is all about Germany. And for Europe to work, the Germans have to be willing to, first of all, pay some big bills and offer some significant support to the weaker European countries. And then second of all, they have to be willing to reverse what has been their economic strategy of the past decade. They have had export-led growth, and they have benefited from the euro because the euro has meant that their currency has been weaker than it would have been if they were still on the Deutschmark. The Germans have to be willing to put up with inflation at home, rising wages, weaker German exports, and they have to let the rest of Europe, especially the South, export their way to growth. Now, that's a big ask, yes. But the collapse of Europe would be really devastating for Germany, and so far Germany has been the biggest beneficiary.
John Healy, there you are, not just across the pond, but all the way out in California. How are you taking all this on board this week? I mean, in some ways, California is resonating with the crisis over there. You've got Jerry Brown talking about your own fiscal problems of a, you know, mega billion order. On the other hand, you've got Facebook going out as one of the biggest IPOs in history. We're talking billionaires and millionaires all over the place. How's Europe look to you, John?
It looks alien. I mean, at a certain point, you get in Germany, they talk about donor fatigue. In the United States and in California, it's maybe debt fatigue. The numbers that we're talking about here are just beyond the comprehension of most people.
Especially after you have to go ahead and try and bail out Italy and Spain. We're up to moon level.
Right. So I think what people can grasp is when you talk about things that are very close to them, the potential that the California public schools are going to have to cut 3 weeks of instructional time if there isn't an additional certain number of billions of dollars brought into to the state. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing people can grasp. The idea that German attitudes about bond debt somehow are going to influence whether the United States economy and the California economy recovers faster, that's really abstract.
And that abstraction hovering over some really tough realities this week. You had your governor, California Governor Jerry Brown. Here he was in a video released on Saturday talking about your state's, California's, fiscal situation.
We're now facing a $16 billion hole, not the $9 billion we thought in January. This means that we will have to go much further and make cuts far greater than I asked for at the beginning of the year.
Jack Beatty, look across this horizon from all the way over in Greece to all the way over in California. We've got, you know, enormous challenges here. Europe still not sure how to deal with it. Potentially huge implications for the U.S. and global economy there in California, as John says, they're talking lopping weeks off the school year. We are up against some tough ones here, Jack.
We are, and we need to think in the alternative. This week, Lord Skidelsky, the Keynes biographer and a sometime on-point guest, really helped get that going by reminding us what Keynes thought about these debt crises. He felt that creditors and debtors shared responsibility for getting economies out of the holes, quote, they had jointly dug. And he wrote that the absolutists of contract, meaning in this case, I guess, Angela Merkel, are the real parents of revolution. One of the lessons of history, according to Skidelsky, is that sovereign debt must be managed in ways that don't destroy either the economy or the political center ground. And in Greece, German forced austerity has destroyed the economy and weakened
the
parties.
You've got fascists and leftists and everybody up on the up there.
Yeah. Will Europe be better off if extremist parties gain power? You know, morality is about what's right. German economics about what works. Germany is right morally, but looks wrong economically. Wrong for Greece. Wrong for Europe, wrong for the interdependent world.
Let's hear about how some of this was coming home this week. We heard a bit of Mitt Romney at the top, but here's some more. This was a Wednesday in Des Moines. We talked about that prairie fire of debt. People came after him on that, saying, well, where'd the debt come from? Bush tax cuts and so on. But here, he's unleashing a scathing attack on President Obama's record.
President Obama is an old school liberal whose first instinct is to see free enterprise as the villain and government as the hero. America counted on President Obama to rescue the economy, to tame the deficit, and help create jobs. Instead, he bailed out the public sector, gave billions of your dollars to companies of his friends, and added almost as much debt to this country as all the prior presidents combined.
Now, the fact checkers have been all over that paragraph, and they've got a lot of questions to raise about it. But, Christian, what about the way the economic challenges are being laid out this week? Joe Biden talking about dignity, Mitt Romney talking about debt.
Well, I think that it is going to be very interesting to see how, you know, the euro crisis plays into the U.S. political debate. Just one point of fact, which may seem perverse and paradoxical, but it is that actually, in at least in the short term, the euro crisis means that all this talk about U.S. debt and how no one is going to lend to the U.S. anymore and so forth,
yeah,
it's just not true. Treasury bonds are such a safe haven right now that we're practically in the position where people are paying the U.S. government to hold their money.
And you've got people saying, take that cheap money and help boost the economy now. Let's do some spending here.
Right. I mean, and so I think that does weaken the argument of the bond vigilantes who have been saying, you know, look, this is an urgent crisis. The wolf is at the door. If you don't deal with it right away, there will be disaster. That is not what the markets are saying. The markets are saying the world is very happy to keep on lending the U.S. money.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. There's Mark Zuckerberg and the opening bell in New York on the stock market this morning as Facebook prepares what, at the time of this airing, very soon to take its shares public. We're looking at a week in the news, Greece on the edge, Facebook fever, attack ad fever. We'll look at that Trayvon Martin evidence out this week with John Healy, editorial board member of the Los Angeles Times, Christian Freeland from Thomson Reuters Digital, and our own Jack Beatty. John, give us your California perspective on Facebook. You're going to have a lot of billionaires and millionaires among you, even, did I read, maybe $2 billion to the California Treasury off taxes on the stock options and everything else that are flowing out there right now? How's it look to you, John, this offering?
I think that number may be a little high.
Okay. But
yeah, it's going to be a windfall of sorts to California. The state budget, I think, already anticipates a lot of that revenue, so it's not going to be much of a rescue for the predicament that the state is now in. But it's just another, I think, example of how the economy here in California relies to its discredit on the boom and bust of capital gains. There's the tax, the revenue system for the state is heavily weighted on personal income taxes. And so when you have big capital gains, it helps. When you have dry years, suddenly the bottom falls out.
So you've had a kind of a net boom, or some say bubble, recently, and here's Facebook. I mean, what are you hearing in your circles, John? Are people looking at this kind of $100 billion expected valuation out of this and saying, yeah, that makes sense? Or give us the California view. Are people rolling their eyes and say Facebook's overvalued here? What are you hearing?
Well, there are a couple of camps on this. The move by General Motors earlier this week to stop advertising on Facebook is a signal of sort of the skeptical camp that says, yeah, there's lots and lots and lots of users, but they're not effectively monetized yet. It's a great place for General Motors to have a page, but as far as directing ads to Facebook users, when people are on Facebook, they don't pay any attention to the ads. So maybe it isn't a great advertising vehicle, and $100 billion is way too high a valuation. Then there's the other camp that says, yes, but you're reaching virtually everybody in the global population. Mm. Somebody's going to figure out how to do that, and it is going to be a gold mine. So yet again, we're going to have to wait and see how effectively it's used. But you can't get past the reality that it is the only major social network left, and it's sticky. People may not like Facebook, but they can't stop using it.
Euro crisis and Facebook fever all at the same time. That's going to be really interesting to just track that stock and over the next hours and days and see how it rolls. Let's go to our listeners. Atlanta, Georgia, Ben is calling. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, I'm just looking at when you were talking about Europe, and especially with Greece. The one problem with Greece is there's so many countries outside of Europe that are interconnected, such as Russia and China and the U.S. tax bubble and the possible housing bubble in China and the instability in the Russian government right about now, that it really does worry me that if the chain reaction was to occur, we could go and see much worse the recession that we experienced back in 2000.
I think that's exactly what people are worried about right now. And it's interesting how in this, you know, plugged-in age, people all over the world, Jack, it's been interesting to see this week. I mean, it's little Greece, and there you've got stock markets everywhere and investors and regular people everywhere who know about it, who are tracking it from the Peloponnese to wherever they are on the planet. It's a fascinating moment we're at, Jack.
It is, and a perilous one. I mean, perhaps never before has the world been this interdependent, which is certainly to the good in terms of abating nationalism and creating, bonds across borders and so on. But to the bad, if it makes us vulnerable to events far away among a people we don't know anything about, but who have got themselves in this dilemma and who face a creditor who just isn't going to let up on them. So, yeah, we're all vulnerable.
No turning back unless the power goes down. Mike in Needham, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question. Your guest there mentioned that they're going to have to lay off or shorten the school year.
3 weeks, maybe, in California, yeah.
In California. I wonder, have they ever... In the private sector, many unions have taken pay cuts and benefit cuts to keep their jobs. Has there been any talk whatsoever in California about the public unions taking pay and benefit cuts to help with the budget deficit?
Well, I think there's been a lot of talk, but John Healy, what about the heart of that question? Where does that debate stand?
Well, at the moment, the state employees are going to be asked to take about a 5% pay cut, working fewer hours, still being negotiated by the state, but it is a 5% pay cut. And over the past several years, there's been a lot of push and pull between the governor's office, both Governor Schwarzenegger and Governor Brown, and the employee unions, to get them to face the realities here. It's either layoffs, furloughs, or lower pay. And the unions, you know, they're a negotiating group. They resist as much as they can. But there's been movement. I mean, there's lower pay. There's fewer state workers, fewer positions.
Is there a sense of shared pain in California at this point, then, that everybody's in on the cutbacks or not?
Well, there's always a resentment about the big salaries because there are several thousand California public employees who have high-level jobs, and they get high-level pay, and they have high-level pensions. And that is a point of resentment for many members of the public. They look at, for example, the pay that physicians in the prison system receive, or the director of the stem cell research center.
Yeah.
And they go, why are we paying anybody that amount of money when we've got this much trouble? Well, it's because these are very high-skilled positions. These
big
are
state, professionals. Big operations, yep.
Yeah, and so people focus on that instead of looking at the thousands and thousands of teachers and other lower-level workers who get ordinary levels of pay and are being asked to receive less and less of it.
Jerry Brown was just so starkly bleak in his description of where California stands as we came. He said, we'll do it. But, man, it looked tough. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I think GM's got it wrong about Facebook. Sorry, I got to catch my breath and run around.
No problem. GM, I think, pulled some of its ads or said it wasn't going to do as much Facebook advertising because it wasn't working for them, right?
Yeah, I think they don't know how to interface with social media. So I know that GM's got Camaros. What I don't know is that maybe in June there's a $1,200 rebate on them. That's how they tap into it. Kind of, they're looking long-term. That's a TV thing. Facebook, that's hey, now, wow, do it, and then gone.
So you think GM may be misjudging, maybe Facebook's got more potential on that front, its revenue front, than they think. That got a lot of people's attention to see GM backing off just as Facebook was headed out to the public. I want to turn around and look at another piece of this political climate this week. We had Mitt Romney really going after the president there in your town, Dave, in Des Moines. And at the same time, the Obama campaign coming out with tough ads on Monday, slamming Mitt Romney and Bain Capital's record on jobs. He had former workers from GST Steel in Kansas City telling the story of their company going bankrupt and the mill being shut down after a Bain takeover in 1993. Result, 750 jobs lost.
Bain Capital walked away with a lot of money that they made off of this plant because they took all of the money. We view Mitt Romney as a job destroyer.
To get up on national TV and brag about making jobs when he has destroyed thousands of people's careers, lifetimes, just destroying people.
Jack Beatty, all right, here was a week when there was so much talk about what is fair game for tough ads and tough talk on the campaign trail. Mitt Romney laying a whole lot of debt blame on President Obama. Others saying there's plenty to go around. Joe Biden saying they just don't get the sort of fundamentals of work and then work and pay. And then this report in the New York Times that a big Republican backer might be coming out with a deep attack on President Obama in kind of racial and Jeremiah Wright terms. He came out and repudiated that. Mitt Romney came out and repudiated that and said, don't attack me either, Obama camp. I mean, this issue of painting boundary lines around campaigning this week, Jack, has been very big.
It really has. Speaking in Ohio this week, Joe Biden used Mitt Romney's name 19 times. Only two references were favorable. Romney loves his country. He has a great family. The rest was really a populist attack on Romney as a vulture capitalist. Romney calls this character assassination, and in one statement, he seemed to imply an equivalence between the Obama campaign raising Bain and right-wing billionaires linking Reverend Wright to President Obama in that abortive attack ad that, as you say, Romney deplored. His statements could sound like a warning to Obama Central, stay off Bain or expect more Reverend Wright. And, you know, a second Romney defense of his business career, an interesting one, is shaping up. He's begun contrasting Bill Clinton with Barack Obama. Clinton, Romney's suggesting, would never attack capitalists. He was no radical. But Clinton, who deregulated Wall Street, was naive, really, in believing that finance capital could regulate itself. The economic catastrophe that began in 2008 really proved otherwise. Obama, is he a radical for re-regulating Wall Street or a realist? Romney wants to roll back regulation.
Well, but put it in the context this week of, you know, don't tread on me, don't attack me. But he was saying don't go after the president with this old Jeremiah Wright stuff. This was in response to a New York Times story outlining a GOP super PAC's proposal, just a proposal since repudiated, to go after that history. Romney saying here he disapproved of that strategy.
I want to make it very clear. I repudiate that effort. I think it's the wrong course for a PAC or a campaign. I hope that our campaigns can respectively be about the future and about issues and about a vision for America. I've been disappointed in the president's campaign to date, which is focused on character assassination.
Now, that billionaire Joe Ricketts came out and said, no, I'm not going to fund that campaign anyway. But, Christian Freeland, what about this back and forth about what's fair game in the presidential campaign? I mean, we're historically, not too mamby-pamby about it. Presidential campaigns get tough. Vice presidents in particular throw some pretty big punches. We've seen a lot thrown. But when it comes to describing our economy, is it fair to call that or someone's business background, is that character assassination? What about Obama's own background?
So I think that this is going to be a very tough campaign, and I think that the lines between the two candidates are going to be the contrast is going to be a very sharp one, and I think that that's a very good thing. I think that this is a very, very consequential election. It's consequential because the moment in the economic life of the United States and actually of the world, this is a transformative moment. You know, we're on one of these hinges of history, and the combination of the Facebook IPO with worries of a new global recession is not an accident. We're in one of these periods of tremendous creative destruction, and a lot of great new things are happening, but a lot of things are also being torn down. And these are moments when societies have to decide how are they going to respond to them. And I do think that Barack Obama and Mitt Romney have very different views about that. And there's going to be a lot of conflict, partly because of genuine ideological difference. But let's not also forget, different people have different vested interests. You know, if you are in the billionaire class, then your biggest fear is deficits and the higher taxes that those ultimately mean. If you are in the sort of left behind class that, you know, where you're losing your jobs because of this tremendous change in the world economy, your concerns are probably pretty different.
House Speaker John Boehner promising a lot more tension around these issues and the U.S. budget over the summer. This was on Tuesday he was talking, saying that the debt limit's going to come back as an issue this summer, and he would not raising it without significant cuts to spending, raising the possibility of another big debt standoff.
When the time comes, I will again insist on my simple principle of cuts and reforms greater than the debt limit increase. Now, this is the only avenue I see right now to force the elected leadership of this country to solve our structural fiscal imbalance.
John Healy, we sort of thought that there had been an agreement about how to handle this last summer, but here's John Boehner saying, no, it's going to get tough, it's going to get hard, and it's going to happen sometime this year. Are we going to be back on that, in that crunch again, John, in the middle of an election season?
We don't have to be. I think that most of the projections show that the debt ceiling won't become an issue fiscally for the Treasury Department until the very end of this year or early next year. So, of course, that depends on the economy. So what Boehner's people say he was doing was he was trying to do the responsible thing, which is to not wait to the last minute, but actually start talking about it early. But the pushback against that is that really this coming election is all about how we proceed on the debt in the future. Are we going to do it the Obama way, which is to include tax increases in the mix, or are we going to do it the Romney way, which is to not include tax increases and maybe even go the other direction on taxes?
So do you see in the Romney way, do you see that deficit being cut back or without new taxes? Is it clear which way it goes?
Well, if you just look at the numbers, it is possible to lower tax rates and still generate at least the same amount of revenue, possibly a little bit more revenue, if you take a hammer and tong at the exemptions, deductions, credits, etc. that permeate the tax code. This is especially true on the individual side more than the corporate side. But that also means
like
saying
mortgage deduction and so on?
Mortgages,
or we don't know because Romney hasn't said exactly what it would be.
He has not said. But if you're going to do what he has proposed to do, you have to go at the very big dollars, and those are in mortgage. They're in the employer deduction for health insurance.
Yeah.
And that one is, you know, it's precious close to sacrosanct unless you look at healthcare reform as moving away from employer-based insurance toward individual-based insurance. And Romney has talked about that too. So if it's part of this, not just a big tax package, but it's sort of a big government overhaul package, then you could do that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a big NATO summit coming in Chicago. Big protest plans, too. Here's Matt McLaughlin with Occupy Chicago, already in the streets.
They're kicking us into the streets.
What's this?
This is a part of a living room, and we're setting up a living room in front of Citibank to show them that, yeah, if you kick us out of your homes, we're going to come to you because we have nowhere else to go now.
The country hits a demographic milestone. The majority of American babies are now non-white. Here's NBC's Ann Thompson.
Brooklyn's Maimonides Medical Center delivers 8,000 babies a year, the most in New York State. It prints information in 10 different languages.
And disco queen Donna Summer died at 63. Boy, was she something. Here's Hot Stuff, 1979. There's a great hour on disco at our website where Donna Summer joined us. Take a listen at onpointradio.org. We're looking at a week in the news right now. Grease on the Edge, Facebook fever, attack ad fever, Trayvon Martin. We'll look at that. Christian Freeland is with us from Thomson Reuters Digital in New York. John Healy at the Los Angeles Times joins us from California. Our own Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to our listeners. Carl, Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Carl.
Hey, you know, I was never really worried about the financial stability of the United States. I understand we go in and out of these things. I really never worried about the politics of the moments because I understand politics. Mm. Something this week just shook me to my core when I heard John Boehner saying at a fiscal forum of all places that he's willing to let the American economy default by not raising the debt ceiling. And then it really dawned on me as an American, as a patriotic American, that the raw hatred for President Barack Hussein Obama is real on the Republican side. This time, this is not politics. This is not normal. They're willing to destroy the credit, the economic system of this country in order to get one man out of the White House.
Carl, what makes you think it's that and not a hatred of deficit or debt? Why do you think it's of President Obama?
Because if they hated deficits and debt so much, they wouldn't have had two wars unpaid for. They wouldn't have had Medicaid Part D unpaid for. They wouldn't have all these things they normally spend, and now all of a sudden the deficit halts. It's hypocrisy at its highest. And if I'm President Obama, when they try and pick that fight again, I'll call a press, not a press conference, but I go to the Oval Office in front of the nation, pen in hand, exercising the 14th Amendment and raising the debt ceiling by executive order, because these people are truly putting hatred of one man over love of the country.
Carl, let us pick it up right there. I think we've got it. And Jack, I know you've been thinking on these fronts about sort of leverage and the lines being laid down here.
Well, you know, ostensibly, Boehner was addressing the Obama administration, yet really, I think he was putting the electorate on notice, signaling that a vote for Barack Obama really is a vote for crisis and chaos. He can't say it, but the Republicans wouldn't hold President Romney's economy hostage. Their own budget, after all, includes a decade of borrowing. Bipartisan majorities raised the debt ceiling under Ronald Reagan 17 times. They would raise it under Mitt Romney. It's not borrowing the Republicans are against. Carl is right. It's President Obama. Paul Krugman lightly paraphrases the implied threat this way. You got a nice little economy there. Pity if something bad should happen to it.
Well, you know, vote for Obama, we're taking the whole thing down.
Look what happened last summer. I mean, something bad did happen. Moody's downgraded our credit. Something worse could happen this time, an historic default.
Christian Freeland, we've got listeners coming at it from another angle, though, looking at Europe and maybe thinking about the U.S. too. Karen says, you know, hey, maybe the problems in Europe, especially Greece, indicate some problem. Do they indicate a problem with long-term viability of cradle-to-grave welfare? Nanny states produce nothing of value, have anti-business climates, can't meet all the pension promises they've made. Why did anybody ever think that type of government would last in the first place? Now, Carl says you may have something else going on behind that, but there's Kevin saying straight up he doesn't believe in that economic model that the John Boehner would tie around President Obama's reputation, Christian.
So I think you can draw a lot of different lessons from Europe, but it's just not true to say that the European crisis shows the bankruptcy of the social welfare state. And the best counterexamples are the Northern European countries, particularly Germany, but also the Scandinavian countries. These are countries that are in very robust economic health. They have incredibly generous and comprehensive welfare states, and they also have high taxes. And, you know, that's the deal, and it's absolutely rational. If you as a society are prepared to pay high taxes, you can have a generous social welfare state. And actually, we're seeing from the performance of, you know, the strong European countries that can work incredibly well. Germany actually has, in particular, has been doing very, very well. So have a lot of the Scandinavian states. What we're seeing in a country like Greece, which actually has a very low tax take compared to other Western industrialized countries, is you can't have social welfare and have nobody pay taxes.
Well, nobody pay taxes or an economy that produces the revenue to pay for it, I guess.
Well, no, but the Greek issue is not simply the weakness of the economy, although it has been weak, and it's been weak partly because of self-imposed structural problems, in particular a very rigid labor market. But the other, you know, just basic mathematical thing with Greece has been the tax take is incredibly low. No one in Greece pays taxes. And guess what? When that happens, your country goes broke.
Let's go to Marfa, Texas, and Joe. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well.
This may be a little off base, but on the Greek issue, it reminds me a great deal of the history of pre-World War I. I believe that Greece may be the new Sarajevo. We're not going to have a fighting war, but I believe there's going to be, in Europe in particular, some sort of economic war. The history of how Germany pulled us into World War I and then everybody else is strikingly similar.
You see a fuse down there in the southeast corner.
Yeah, I mean, World War I just started with somebody getting assassinated, and then everybody started, Austria and Germany said, well, they got to pay reparations. And then nobody was really serious about this. Nobody expected it to become what it was. And it seems like the history of the European state is that, and I can think of it as a state now, is that these various countries are doing about the same thing. And I have one other comment about the the deficit and everything worldwide.
Yep.
It seems like since the invention of the silicone chip that we've been able to increase our productivity such that we're producing more items with computer chips than people can possibly afford, that the wages and the number of people on Earth increasing has made it such that them wanting to be replaced to make lower and lower prices using a computer chip, a chip can have infinitesimal new amount of information per chip. It's going to the point where driving prices down has created chips to produce everything.
And there we sit on the sidelines and got to figure out how to buy all that stuff, or if we want to buy all that stuff, and if we don't, what's the economy look like? I want to touch, thank you, Joe, for your call. I want to touch on J.P. Morgan for just a second here. John Healy, I don't know how much attention you've paid to that, but got a lot of attention all over early this week, $2 billion loss, and now it looks like maybe a $3 billion loss, and it could be more. And this question of whether there has been enough going on to get the regulators' arms around the financial industry to keep us from heading back into that terrain where big losses there, we're taking the whole economy down. What do you see going on there, John?
Well, I think you have to bear in mind that we talk about a big loss at J.P. Morgan. End of the day, they're still making money. They were expected to have, according to their CEO, in this coming quarter, in the area of $4 billion in profit. This is even after the $2 billion, now $3 billion loss. So say it gets to be a $4 billion error coming out of London, they're still $2 billion north of a loss overall. So where is this money coming from? Mitt Romney has made this point. This money isn't coming out of the pockets of taxpayers or depositors. This money is coming out of the pocket of investors who will have to reevaluate whether they trust J.P. Morgan again.
Well, that's fine and dandy as long as it's at that scale, but here it comes kind of out of the blue, and if it gets a lot bigger or if it got a lot bigger, we saw what happened last time. I mean, Christian Freeland, are you comfy with this kind of J.P. Morgan sudden announcement? Oops, we lost him.
I think that if you're an investor, then John's argument is absolutely correct, and it is, and you know, that's actually what investors are saying. I've talked to some big hedge funds, and they're saying, you know, we see this as a buying opportunity. We think Jamie Dimon is the best CEO on Wall Street. This is not a big loss. We think the shares are now underpriced, and we are going in. But I think it also raises crucially some systemic issues. And I'm concerned less about the size of the loss and more about the type of loss. Because what this trade tells us is actually, even post-2008, even post-Dodd-Frank, the big universal banks that take in retail deposits are still engaging in casino betting activities. They are trying to have it both ways, be a retail bank and also effectively be a hedge fund, do proprietary trading. This was described initially as, oh, it's just hedging our risk, it's just buying insurance. I don't think it was. I think that this was an effort to speculate on the markets and make a lot of money. And I'm not opposed to that. I think that's terrific. And if you want to do that, go out, set up a hedge fund, and make billions of dollars. But if you are running a bank, which is a systemically crucial bank, which
and
is too big
by
to fail,
taxpayers if it starts
right,
to go
which
down.
Takes retail deposits, which ultimately is backstopped by the state, I don't think you should be able to do that.
A whole lot of new evidence out this week in the Trayvon Martin case. Now, of course, everybody jumped in on this a couple of months ago. Lots of passion around it. We saw it debated up and down and around, and now, 100, 200 pages of new evidence coming out and all kinds of interpretations of what it says. You've got witness here talking about a black male wearing a dark-colored hoodie on top of a white or Hispanic male throwing punches. Said he then heard a pop and observed the person who had previously been observed on top of the other person, the male wearing the hoodie, laid out on the grass. Jack, here this comes back. We've all seen video of George Zimmerman headed into the police station. Didn't look too beat up, but now we're told, no, there was a gash on the back of the head. There were dark eyes. This is going to be poured over and over and over, Jack. People trying to figure out what happened here. And now George Zimmerman's dad saying that wasn't Trayvon Martin crying for help. That was my son.
Yes, that to me was what, and Mr. Martin, Trayvon's father, saying, according to the police report, saying, no, that wasn't my son.
Initially he said that, initially, but then now he's that. Denying that yeah. it's confusing.
And the FBI lab, according to the Times, isn't able to say who it is. So that's a crucial piece of evidence on which the Zimmerman defense rests. I mean, it's a very I expect we're going to start hearing, has the press overreacted to this? Is this level of detail showing that, you know, there was more to it than we thought, that there was a real fight and so on? Well, who knows? I mean, there was also part of this from an anonymous source, so you have to discount it, saying this guy Zimmerman is a racist. I mean, and he's just looking to get black people. I mean, you know, that was from a neighbor calling it. So it's a very ugly matter.
Being interpreted lots of ways. Here's the Trayvon Martin's family attorney, Benjamin Crump, on NBC's Today Show yesterday, saying the new evidence released yesterday by the prosecutors bolsters his case. Why was Zimmerman following Trayvon?
The police determined it was completely avoidable if Jory Zimmerman would have simply stayed in his car. If he wasn't a profile Trayvon Martin and pursued him and confronted him, he wouldn't be in jail. And more importantly, Trayvon Martin would be living today.
There was a scuffle. Wyatt in Middleborough, Massachusetts. Wyatt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I feel like all the new evidence that's come out and the new considerations that seem to be in play all miss the critical point that should have been the only consideration in the first place, and that is, when was a moment of aggression in play? As soon as George Zimmerman got out of the car and started pursuing Trayvon Martin, I think any reasonable person in Trayvon Martin's case would feel threatened. So if there's a stand your ground law, that's the critical question. When was aggression in play?
And what constitutes aggression? I mean, the prosecutors are standing by their charges here, and we'll see how this all plays out in the courtroom. But it doesn't look like it's going to be any quick and simple conclusion out of all this evidence and this going on and on. And that point, John Healy in particular, you know, who was on whose back here? Who was chasing who? Who had the right to feel that they were threatened in a stand your ground state?
The really interesting thing to me is that Zimmerman is essentially saying that Trayvon stood his ground. it's not. It's ironic more than it's humorous. But he is. His defense is built around the fact that Trayvon started hitting him, which, if Trayvon had a gun, one might imagine that he shot first, that he might assert the standard ground defense for using the gun. So it's so circling around itself in a way. And again, jury's going to have to sort through the facts and make their own call.
Here we are after all these years and just this kind of case in our lap and everybody watching it so closely. It's going to be something to see how this one plays out. John Healy, it's good to have you with us. We hope you'll come again. Editorial board member at the Los Angeles Times. Thank you very much for joining us from California today, John.
My pleasure.
Chrystia Freeland with Thomson Reuters Digital in New York. Chrystia, you're terrific. Thank you so much for being here.
It was fun. Thanks.
And Jack Beattie, thanks to have you, Jack. I know Donna Summer brings back all your disco dancing days.
Yes, and we're both from Dorchester, Massachusetts.
So. There you go.
God rest her soul.
Back in the day, that was Some Voice. We'll go out with Donna Summer's Last Dance. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.